Up next, the ongoing debate over the risks and benefits of eating fish. Now, I'm sure you've heard the story about actor Jeremy Piven, who announced he had to pull out of a Broadway play because he ate too much sushi and he got mercury poisoning. And there were reactions that range from skeptical to the scared. I mean, could his tuna really be so toxic? Now, no one disputes that fish can contain mercury, but just how much mercury and how much fish would you have to eat to get sick or not get sick? This is a very hotly debated question. And adding to the confusion, we know that there are known health benefits to eating fish. It's been linked to cardiac health. Omega-3 fatty acids are found in fish. They're vital for neurological development in children. So pregnant women who skip the fish may be doing more harm than good, say public health officials. But just how much is too much? How much should we be allowed to eat? How do we sort through the sometimes contradictory advice and warnings? We're going to debate that issue with my next guest. Jane Hightower is an internal medicine physician and author of Diagnosis Mercury, Money, Politics, and Poison. She joins us from San Francisco. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Hightower.
Thank you for having me, Ira.
You're welcome. Joshua Cohen is a research associate professor of medicine at Tufts Medical Center, and he joins us from Boston. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Cohen.
Glad to be here, Ira.
Let me ask you, Jane, is it really possible to get that kind of poisoning from eating too much sushi?
Well, yes, it is plausible. All through the literature, essentially what I did with Diagnosis Mercury and researching this issue, I wanted to find that same answer. And I researched extensively through all the poisonings that occurred, all the lawsuits that occurred, and there was a common denominator that you had these lesser symptoms, or what some people refer to as subjective Minamata disease. And there are these nonspecific symptoms that arise in people who are sensitive to mercury. Not everybody's going to get them at the same level. But these symptoms occur throughout history, and it occurs before you get the more serious symptoms.
Mm. Dr. Cohen, do you think it's plausible he could have gotten poisoned from eating too much sushi or tuna?
Well, of course, I don't know the details of this
right.
particular case, but yeah, sure, it's plausible. We know that mercury is a toxin. As Dr. Hightower just said, there have been events documented where people exposed to very high levels of mercury have, in fact, exhibited acute symptoms. And, of course, the question is, how relevant is that to the average consumer?
Right. We're going to get into this this question about toxicity of mercury and health advice for eating fish. Should not give up eating fish? What are the health consequences? What's public health versus what you'd want to do on your own? Give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. Also, we're Twittering on SciFry. That's at SciFry. If you'd like to send us a tweet. And also in Second Life on the Science Friday Island, you can get in on the conversation and join the avatars there. We're going to take a quick break, come back and talk lots more with Jane Hightower and Joshua Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatto. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about fish and mercury with my guest, Jane Hightower, an internal medicine physician and the author of Diagnosis Mercury, Money, Politics, and Poison. Joshua Cohen, Research Associate Professor of Medicine at Tufts Medical Center, 1-800-989-8255. Let's talk a bit about Jane, give us a little background on what is mercury, the different kinds, organic, inorganic, how we get it, things like that.
Well, the predominant exposure that we get is through fish, and that's an organic mercury. Of course, the dental amalgams also give you an inorganic mercury, but does not really raise blood levels, but will raise your urine excretion level. But the biggest hits we get intermittently is through the large predatory fish. Our fish obtain it through the soils and the environment. The bacteria take up mercury. The small fish or the plankton take up the bacteria. The small fish eat the plankton. And it gets amplified up the food chain to where the largest predators and the longest live are the ones with the highest mercury levels. So for fish that's commercial or non-commercial, you can have very wide ranges of mercury levels in the fish.
Mm-hmm. What does it do to our bodies once it gets in there in too high a level?
Well, one of the things I do have to say is that there's never been a blinded placebo-controlled trial giving humans methylmercury and omega-3s together and see what happens to them and see what the full spectrum effects are. So what we do know through the literature is that there's associations that have been found in different populations. Nonspecific symptoms are one of them, and the Japanese have clearly delineated some of these: headache, troubles thinking, memory loss, muscle and joint pains, etc. And then you have the where Joshua Cohen has done wonderful work on looking at all the cardiovascular effects of whether it increases coronary artery disease and what level it does. Also, induction or autoimmune antibodies, infertility in men, damage neuropsychiatrically. And these are looking at mercury, and essentially there's somewhere where mercury will negate the good effects of omega-3s. So the message is you want to get omega-3s, hold the mercury, please.
Mm-hmm. Joshua Cohen, would you agree with that?
Well, certainly more mercury is not as good as less mercury. And, if we could just get rid of the mercury, or if, for example, mercury were found only in donuts, we could tell people not to eat donuts, and that would probably not pose any trade-off questions. The problem is, as Dr. Hightower pointed out, mercury is in fish, and fish have nutritional benefits. And so what we're dealing with here is a question of trade-offs. And in order to understand what we should be doing in this situation as a result, we need to understand how large the harms are associated with the mercury exposure and how that compares to the benefits.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that the benefits are better to eat the fish than to be worried about the mercury?
When one looks at the literature as a whole, and of course, as Dr. Hightower noted, we don't have randomized controlled trials for a whole bunch of reasons. It certainly wouldn't be ethical. But we do have observational studies, and when you look at them all together, it suggests that, on the whole, the benefits do outweigh the risks.
1-800-989-8255. Would you agree with that, Jane?
Well, that's a very oversimplified approach because it's regional as far as our mercury elevations go. And, I do risk management, not risk analysis. So if I have someone who had a heart attack and has a mercury of 20, I'm certainly not going to tell him, oh, the benefits outweigh the risk. I'm going to get that mercury down.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to apply what's in the literature to the private practice or the individual, and it becomes a different scenario.
So you have a different – in fact, that's always been a problem with prescribing in general for the public. I mean, from individual cases and simplifying for the public. For example, doctors will all tell you that a glass of wine or two is pretty good for you, but the public health officials will never say that to the general public. So they have sort of different standards about that. And this you're saying is sort of the same case.
Correct. I agree because what I'm seeing, I'm in a high-risk population area. Coastal people, the Asian Pacific Islanders, higher-income people tend to have higher mercury levels. And there's a wonderful paper by Mahaffey that clearly delineates that. That's an environmental health perspective this month. And what we need to do is look at, okay, what's the general population? What is their risk? Most people don't have to worry about the mercury in the fish they eat because they're not choosing the large predators.
Mm-hmm.
But for those of who are eating the albacore every day or the sushi every day, like Mr. Piven, choosing the sea bass, the swordfish, the ahi steaks on a regular basis, they're the ones that we need to monitor.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Lindsay in Denver. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi. My question was, when I first found out I was pregnant, fish oil supplements were recommended to me. And so I'm just wondering about taking the fish oil supplements that, say on the bottle, mercury undetectable, both during pregnancy and then after for the benefits.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cohen?
Yes, certainly. One thing that we do have when it comes to omega-3 fatty acids is that we do have a series of, albeit small, randomized trials that looked at women who received supplements omega-3 fatty acid supplements, and that did improve the neurological function of their children. So there we can say that, in fact, omega-3 fatty acids in isolation do have a positive benefit. We don't have to worry about, well, was it something else in the fish that was providing that benefit? That being said, one still has to think about, you know, again, from a population perspective, if you're not eating fish, you are eating something else. And the question is the something else that you're eating going to be better for you than the net benefit that you would receive from the fish?
I should point out, Dr. Cohen, that your work was supported by a grant from the National Food Processors Association Research Foundation and the Fisheries Scholarship Fund. So do you think that has any influence on your research at all?
Well, of course, that's a fair question to ask. And we always want to make sure that our science is objective. And as a result, Harvard University and Tufts University academic institutions in general have a series of safeguards. And in particular, I mean, to sum it up briefly, basically, they provide the funds and then it's hands off. But even beyond that, there's also the peer review process. Mm-hmm. The work that we did was published in a peer-reviewed journal, and of course, the peer reviewers had absolutely no connection with the sponsorship.
Let me ask both of you, Dr. Hightower and Dr. Cohen, do you think that because you're finding cases of mercury poisoning in people, Jane, and you write about it in your book, that mercury levels should be a routine part of your yearly examination that you get?
Well, what I do is I take a dietary history, and people are so savvy here in the Bay Area that they know when they've overdone it. My sensitive individuals, they say, well, you know, I'm starting to get the same symptoms again. I got to back off. And they're certainly not frightened of this issue. They're just trying to learn how to work around it. I will take a dietary history, and I can actually calculate and get an estimate of about where their body's going to be. So I pretty much have an idea of who needs to be tested. For those doctors who do not know how to do that, then I suggest if they're eating fish on a regular basis, just go ahead and do a blood mercury test, which will give you sort of a spot check, or you can do a hair analysis that will give you sort of an average over the month. And it gives that patient a ballpark figure as to where they stand, and what we're trying to do is keep the mercury level less than 5 micrograms per liter.
Mm-hmm. If I could add something in response to that, I mean, I think, you know, Dr. Hightower deals with a particular population that consumes a lot of fish, I guess a lot of fish that are particularly high in mercury. But I think, in terms of the United States in general, we have to remember our fish consumption as a country is particularly low. We're about on the order of 1/10 what you see in places like Japan and Taiwan. And, you know, so it raises another trade-off question. We all know now that doctors have limited time when they see us. And so the question is sort of as a general policy, is this where we would want the doctors investing their time when we go in for a checkup?
It doesn't take much time. 2 seconds, and it's a very cheap test. And it's much cheaper to do that test then, let's say, a thyroid test, which is over $100. A mercury test, a lot of times, is less than $20. And thousands of dollars have been spent of the insurance company's dollar trying to diagnose people with these nonspecific symptoms when it only took a $20 test. So physicians, this is a clinical issue, and we deal with this in medicine all the time, where, you know, we went through this in the Bay Area with HIV. We were a region that had high rates. In other places in the country, they never heard of such a thing. So you really have to know your patient population as a clinician.
Is there any way, I mean, to go out and buy fish and know that it's mercury-free or low in mercury? Why are no supermarkets seeing that, hey, this is an advantage I could give over other supermarkets and only buy from suppliers who've tested the fish or know that the catch they have is lower in mercury?
Well, this technology has been offered to the FDA, and the technology is there to choose every fish, but the FDA does not want to be a testing facility, and their response was, well, what do we do with the fish that don't pass? So that was part of their issue. You know, what we need is to be able to know what the high, medium, and low mercury fish are at the point of sale and let the see what the market will bear, but the fishing industry does not want to go along with that. My patients are learning which are the low, high, and medium mercury fish. And but part of the problem with the current advisory is it's too strict for some fish and not strict enough for others.
What do you mean?
Well, there's some fish that a pregnant woman could eat more than twice a week.
Such as?
And there's some fish on the list that, a lot of the folks involved say they shouldn't eat at all. There's always albacore is a question of whether pregnant women should eat. Because why choose that fish when you can choose one that has omega-3s without the mercury?
Such as?
I'm sorry, what?
Such as?
Such as the salmon, herring, sardines, those kind of fish, the smaller fish.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cohen, how do you react to the idea that maybe we should have ratings of, or things like that, or let people judge for themselves where to buy it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think people, you know, more information is better than less information, and FDA does have information on the average concentrations of mercury that they've measured in fish. And I think it's important to talk for a moment about this issue, about whether it's the average that's important or whether we have to worry about getting that particularly, you know, bad fish that has a high level of mercury, even though, you know, the next day we might get a fish serving that is lower and brings the average down. And it's important to understand that what your body sees is the average mercury exposure over time. So saying that a single serving of fish can pose a problem is sort of like saying, this is a rough analogy, but it's sort of like saying that eating those three pieces of pie on Thanksgiving by itself will cause you to become overweight.
Dr. Hightower?
Well, that's not a real good analogy, because being overweight doesn't necessarily cause neurological damage to your child. So what we don't want is those big hits. And many scientists do feel that one large hit during the any time in pregnancy where the child is developing, where they're sensitive, could pose a problem. And a lot of scientists have argued whether the one-hit theory versus average theory, which one prevails. And I don't think that's ever been really sorted out, because there's scientists on both sides that are arguing the point.
Talking about mercury this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Jane Hightower, who is author of Diagnosis, Mercury, Money, Politics, and Poison, and Joshua Cohen, Research Associate Professor of Medicine at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Cohen, do you think there needs to be more work on this?
Well, you know, we researchers always like to say more research
right.
is needed.
I'm familiar with that.
You know, certainly there is more information that we could use in certain areas. But, you know, we do have a pretty good understanding right now of what the average impact, or I should say the aggregate impact of fish is on neurological development, and that seems to be a positive benefit. In the last, I think it was last year, a study of some 12,000 children who were born in the UK, where the mothers had kept track of what they had consumed during pregnancy, that was looked at, and what that study found was that women who had consumed more than 12 ounces of fish per week, which is the recommended limit right now, their children had had better neurodevelopment than the children who had consumed less. And you see similar studies on the cardiovascular disease side.
Mm.
But I'd like to comment that if that was the Hibbeln paper,
yes.
That paper was highly criticized by the statisticians, because actually they put some of the high mercury fish within the categories of the low mercury fish, which canceled out the mercury effect. So that wasn't a real good paper that could really tell us that information. I think the bottom line is choose your poisons wisely and rotate your poisons, because the whole, across the board, mercury is bad, omega-3s in fish are good, and we need to make the mercury very low, as low as we can, while we get the omega-3s. And fish is not the only game in town where you can get omega-3 fatty acids.
You could eat them in different kinds of seeds and things like that?
Correct. Nuts and seeds, you know, the eggs that have omega-3s, you know, the vegetarian flax-fed hens. You get grass-fed beef. Of course, there's different problems with the beef, but at least you can get omega-3s from other sources and eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. So it's what you don't eat, if you don't eat the fish, it's what you substitute for that's actually even more important. And food history is really difficult to really look and see what people are eating and what causes health, because or good health or bad health, because people are looking for a miracle nutrient, and the fishing industry continues to call their product a miracle nutrient. And if they continue to do so and not give adequate information as to the contaminants, I'm going to see a lot more victims in all this.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back and talk a little bit more about fish and mercury poisoning, and what kinds of fish, and maybe how to judge get some advice on how you should judge for yourself if you should stay away from certain kinds of fish or not. Joshua Cohen is with me, also Jane Hightower, author of Diagnosis, Mercury, Money, Politics, and Poison. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, talking about mercury and fish with Jane Hightower, author of the book Diagnosis, Mercury, Money, Politics, and Poison. Joshua Cohen, Research Associate Professor of Medicine at Tufts Medical Center, on number 1-800-989-8255. Jane, can you test someone's hair to see what their mercury exposure is?
Yes, you can. You want to get it at a reputable lab. These tests now with technology are accurate enough for a clinician's use. And they can really give you a good estimate of mercury over time. And mercury stays into the hair follicle, actually the whole hair. It gets bound up into the hair like rings on a tree. So you can use it forensically. So I've had people that couldn't get in to see me for a few months, and they've already stopped the consumption. They wanted to know what they were 3 months ago, where you can, if they have long enough hair, you can figure that out.
Let's go to the phones. Greg in Boise, Idaho. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
Well, we live in an area where we have a lot of gold mines and other mines that use mercury. So, I was wondering if there's a concentration around here, and you've already kind of identified different ways that I can test for it, but if I do have a high concentration, does it dissipate slowly out of my body over time, or is it something that there are certain things I can do to get it out of me?
Joshua Cohen?
Other than saying that the half-life, meaning the amount of time it takes for the current concentration in your body to drop to half its current level, that's about 50 days or so, depending on which tissue you look at. That's what I know. I do not know of any particular treatments for accelerating that process.
Dr. Hightower?
Yes, this has been looked at before. Many of the alternative care doctors use a substance called chelation. But the consensus for a lot of the experts in this area, medical and professor PhDs, was that you really don't need a chelator. I have not recommend a chelator for any of my patients. The treatment is to stop the exposure, and the mercury will eventually work its way out, because the chelators will take all the mercury and send it through the kidney instead, which, you know, we just don't have enough information to know if that's safe. And some of these chelators have other adverse effects that you wouldn't want. So I always call that giving a poison to a poison.
Well, a question from Second Life here from Serene Jewel, who says, will there be a home mercury test soon?
That technology is coming soon. I think with the microanalytical systems who have a website, the developers already have a testing kit that you can test every fish that comes to the market, as long as you have the large machine that goes with the little testing units. I think that in my lifetime I'll probably could see this test coming to fruition for the average person, because it's a good monitor. And like I said, you know, this is not any scare tactics. People are just, you know, they're saying, okay, you know, this can cause me to feel bad and not go to work. I better make sure that that's not the cause. Mm-hmm. So they want to monitor themselves and continue to eat fish.
So, you know, as you say, you're not advocating people don't eat fish.
Correct. In fact, you know, my patients are the high-end consumers. We do love fish. And I have a lot of data that shows that there are some patients that can really eat a lot, like every day, certain types of fish, and their mercury levels stay below 5. And so it's not the actual fish amount. It's the mercury content of the fish, because I have other people who were well within the FDA current guidelines of 12 ounces a week, and they weren't eating the big four, yet two times a week put them over the mark. So you have to choose wisely, especially if you're a person that's sensitive to the mercury, and not everyone is.
When you say choose wisely, what do you mean by that?
I always tell people choose a smaller fish. If you have a big fish, don't get a bigger pot or a plate, get a smaller fish. So generally speaking, with the exception of salmon, which is not a long-lived predatory fish, you want to choose the smallest of the fish.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree, Dr. Cohen?
Well, you know, I absolutely agree that if you can consume fish with less mercury, you're going to be better off. My concern is really the following. I look at it, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Dr. Hightower is a medical doctor. She's a clinician. She sees individuals. I work in the field of health economics. I tend to think more in a policy sense for broad populations. And what I'm concerned about is, you know, the impact that the media reporting on the mercury issue and the government advisory can have on overall population behavior. You asked before what research might need to be done. I actually thought of something if somebody wants to fund this work. What we really need to understand is how does the advisory, for example, by the U.S. EPA and FDA, what has that done to fish consumption? Have people followed the advisory as it was intended, in which case we could see a beneficial effect because people would be shifting their consumption to the low mercury fish? Or have people just sort of gotten the message, you know, fish, mercury, fish must be bad, therefore I'm going to cut my fish consumption? And even worse, are people like middle-aged men, middle-aged women who are beyond childbearing years, are they decreasing their fish consumption and hence losing out on the cardiovascular disease protection benefits?
Well, the third option might be we're all so eager to eat fish, maybe we'll do something about getting the mercury out from the pollution.
Well, I have an answer to Dr. Cohen's comment.
Oh, well, quickly, because I only about have a minute left.
It's Kate Mahaffey, U.S. EPA, wrote the paper, and it tells all the data on that, and they use the NHANES data. No, people haven't changed their fish consumption. What the higher quartile and mercury level patients did was just change the types of fish they chose.
The problem with that is that study did not.
There's data that says that people have reduced consumption. They just changed the number, the types of fish.
The problem with that study is that it didn't control for other factors that are changing over time, such as prices. A study by Jay Shimshak at Tufts University, when they looked at the 2001 advisory, what they found was that, in fact, people were cutting their fish consumption.
All right, we'll have to take this offline because we've run out of time. I want to thank Jane Hightower, internal medicine physician and author of Diagnosis, Mercury, Money, Politics, and Poison. Joshua Cohen, Research Associate Professor of Medicine at Tufts Medical Center. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.